Jeremy.
Hello.
Hi, it's Richard Baird tonight.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, and you?
Not too bad.
How are you?
Fine, how are you?
Very good. What's the time over there?
It's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So, welcome finally to Stir the Pot.
I know, it's nice to be able to put a moving face on the Twitter stuff now.
Yeah. So it's good. It's a small world.
I know. I miss New York. I went there 2 years ago. I loved it there.
Ah, okay.
And I want to go back there again.
Ah, and when will you be coming back?
Well, it all depends with my publisher, really. But I'm due for a tour again. Hopefully next year, yeah.
Ah, good, good. So we'll have to meet when you come in.
Absolutely, yeah. I didn't know anybody when I came there, so I went to do a thing with Grow My Magazine before they closed down.
Right.
And did a video for them. And I loved it there. There's so much to do there.
That's your famous video with the sweetbread, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. The most watched video in Gourmet ever.
There you go. Well, I have the video from your book, so I enjoyed that one. That's a real good one from Doe. Yeah.
Very good. So your bread is right, aren't you?
You know, I'm just a home baker. I cook most of the time, every day, but bread is like my passion, and I kind of wish I had gone into that rather than cooking, but, you know, I'll take both.
Take both, yeah. No, that's good. It's good.
Let me start out by asking, how did you get into baking?
Oh, Christ. I guess I came to baking when buying your bread every day when I was growing up in France. I became a baker by necessity, really. I left school when I was 14. And by the age of 12, I remember vividly going to the bakery every morning and, you know, always peeping through the door. I always remember seeing the baker loading the oven behind the door, set to a jar. And I was always amazed by them being covered in flour, you know, that kind of rugged look, you know, pair of shorts and small t-shirt and working very hard. And you, in a way, I knew it was a bad job to get into because it was bloody hard, but it was very tempting. And one day I found myself behind that door, and I was working there for about 4 years as an apprenticeship. So it's in your blood, you know, you buy your bread every day and you become hooked onto it somehow. And when I left school, I didn't know what to do, and it just come to me, the bakery stuff, and I never looked back after that. I baked there for a few years and, you know, did a bit of cooking when I came to UK, but bread's always been, when you start, it's always part of you. You can't, it never leave you. You can be a great baker and become a cook, but you know, you can be a cook and it's very hard to get a baker. If you cook, if you know how to bake, you know how to cook. Uh-huh. It's a funny job.
So it wasn't hard to transition from a baker as opposed to a chef becoming a baker?
Hard, no. It was, again, I became a chef by necessity. I started cooking when I came to UK. Because my first job I applied for when I arrived in UK 23 years ago was working in an in-store bakery for a supermarket. And they turned me down because my English was not good enough at the time. I said, okay, dude, that's fine. And I met up with a guy called Jean-Christophe Novelli, the chef, and we became a very good friend for many years. And he teach me how to cook. And I said to him, I can't cook. I never cook. And I work in the kitchen. He said, you're a baker. You know how to cook. And that's always stayed with me. You can judge, you know, cooking and baking are two different jobs. But if you know how to bake, you can cook. So it's the way I cook is very, very simple. My books on food are very, very simple. Home cooking, and I like teaching very simple things to people. I'm not a Michelin star chef, but I like cooking for friends. So it's the kind of food you want to eat, really. So I had a few HF positions in some big hotel and did more formal food and things. But I guess everything I've done in my life so far was to do what I'm doing now. It's kind of a massive jigsaw. Who just brought me everything together. So the cooking school, of course, became the element of the jigsaw that I never knew, you know, 6 years ago before I opened the cooking school. So it's nice to put everything I've done in my life so far all together.
And what are, if you could explain in a short sentence or so, what are the differences between cooking and bread baking?
Oh, Christ. It's one thing I always see the guy when they come in my kitchen. Don't ever, ever, ever say cooking bread. I cannot bear. Because in the English language, you've got two different words for two different things.
Right.
You never say to anybody, I'm going to bake a steak. You don't, do you?
No,
you cook. And baking is something you do in the oven. Something you I don't know, baking is too, it's very, very different. I can't bear when you say, how long are you cooking the bread for? It's just, it's another job. It's a different dimension.
Yeah.
So I like the right terminology for the right for the right job. And I know in French it's different. Cuire, which is the verb for baking, yes. It's a general. It's a general term for everything. But in the English language, we've got two different words for two different specific jobs. And right. Baking is something you do in the oven. It's not something you do on the stove. So anything to do with bread, something you put in the oven, it's more like baking or roasting, you know. But for bread, as a bread thing. So I always tell my guys when they come and do a class with me, there's a few words you don't use in here is baking, you know, you don't cook bread ever. Bake bread. Seem like a baker, you bake like one.
And what's the... What is the what percent of baking is skill versus numbers, the percentages, or even science or art?
Like I said, I was not the brightest at school. I was not very. I always wanted something different. So I think baking is something you do more with your heart. I know a lot of bakers who can't count on the rest, but they know. There's something inside you, a real baker. You recognize them in France. You see them. I employ bakers sometimes by the way they sweep the floor. It's an affinity you've got with your surroundings. Something you do by the respect of what's around you. It's the old way of apprenticeship. The way we used to teach people is the way you respect from the flour. The way you respect the dough. The way you handle it. It's not about the brain. The brain of a baker is a funny thing. How can I explain that? It's a kind of, I would say to people, a baker is a very boring person because you've got to be at the same time every day at the same place. And your brain will be consistent if you do the same thing all the time, every time the same. And we always crave for that consistency all the time. And if you see a baker in France, they always start at the same time. They always finish at the same time. They know where they are at 4 o'clock in the morning, at 2 o'clock in the morning. It's a kind of... It's so precise in a way, but it's not written anywhere. It's a kind of unwritten rule that in their head, they know, they come in the morning, if it's cold, they know in their head, before they even touch the mixer, the water temperature, they know how the dough is going to react. It's something you, it's part of you, it's so textile, it's so something you've got to feel part of, that it's not pressing button in the machine like a lot of bakery can do now, but the real bakery, the feel of it was, it's part of you, and real baker are really it's a real art. There was a great TV series not long ago, an American guy called, I can't remember what he's called, but the man who ate everything, and he went to France. I learned something I never realized. I knew, but I didn't realize it. The French are the master of fermentation. They understand the fermentation process, from the cheese, from bread, of course, from the wine, from everything is about fermentation. It's understanding your surrounding, understanding how nature react with product. So if you can master that, it's incredible what you can do with it. And mastering the dough, mastering the making flour, water, or yeast or wild yeast, working with the environment around you in your hand. Together, it's beautiful. It's something you do from. It's a secret ingredient. It's your heart. It's your soul. It's something you put in there. That's I think for a lot of people, it's a quest. It's something they're always looking for. That secret ingredient. It's a respect of what's around. If it makes sense.
Oh, of course. Well, yeah. I mean. I'm baking bread actually as we're speaking. So well, I baked some this morning and I'm rising another dough now that my wife is out of the house and out of my what little hair I have left on my head.
You become a bread bull. I always warn people. The first thing I say to my classroom when they start, I say, one word of warning. After today, a day with me, you will become a bread bull. And they all laugh. They say, what do you mean? I say, every time you go to a dinner party, you make your own bread and you will be there like a puppy waiting for somebody to mention the word bread. And so somebody mentioned the word bread, you'd be there jumping. Your other half would say, oh, no. Because you bore people to death by bread. It's something bread does to people. It's incredible. People get into it.
And what do you think that is, and why are people so enamored by bread once they've been bitten by the fermentation bug?
I was talking to the BBC last week, and they asked me the same question. I said, It's because it's part of our DNA. We all a bit of hunter-gatherer baker. It's such an ancient form of it's ingrained into us. It's part of our like making fire. It's part of survival stuff. If it's a war tomorrow, you will see everybody will want a bag of flour and some water. And if you got flour and water, you can survive. You know, you can survive any crisis. It's the first form of food we fed on. You know, with hunting. So it's got primeval in a way. It's incredible what it does. And I think the whole in England, I can see the revival of going back to basic completely. And I'm sure in America it's the same. It's people. I've gone around. We've done every type of food in the world now. If you want good sugar, if you want good chocolate, if you want good eggs, if you want good meat, we understand all of this. Now the last thing we still haven't really, really tackled head on is bread. And it's a big battle at the moment with the bread campaign to get good bread back on the shelf as well. And the only thing I ask people really is to read the packaging and to make their own mind up. They, you know, if you buy a small bar of chocolate as a treat, you understand exactly what you're eating. If you really want to treat yourself, you buy a very, very good bar of chocolate. You understand about the cocoa powder. You understand about the 72%. And it's a treat. It's a treat. We understand every type of food. And bread is the last thing we still... If you look at the white sliced bread or stuff, we still trade on advertising, selling the dream of the old days. But what's happened now with the big sliced bread, it is not as good now as it's always been. It's not. It's impossible. But the dream of it is, and we need to make people realize what they're eating actually is not what they think it is, and they got to read the packaging. And it's very easy for the marketing team to put a veil on the front of people. Just buy the white sliced bread there because it's got best of both, and it's going to last you longer. And it's not meant to be to do that. It's a kind of I don't know. It's a lot of people are waking up to it now, big time, and we see a big change now. This year, bread is well recognized, and next year is going to be even bigger. So we see a change, I think, a big change now, and hopefully the revival of small bakery. We've seen the butchers, we've seen the greengrocer, the farmers market, and bread now is part of that. But I think with a lot of countries who lost their bread tradition, like UK, for example. We need the chef to kind of associate themselves with bakers as well. We need, because chefs are right at the top and bakers still a bit behind. And we need the chef to bring bread with them a bit, to put it part of the gastronomy a bit. And a lot of chefs can't bake, you know. And that's a funny thing. So it's bread is left at the last minute sometimes, and they don't understand bread.
Actually, some chef on Twitter was saying that. Why do people warm up bread all the time? I mean, it's silly to serve hot bread at the table. I mean,
it's the worst thing you can do to your stomach. If you want your guys not to sell pudding, give them hot bread because you will fill them up. It's a kind of it's a myth. It's like baking hot bread in your house before you sell it. You just think your house is going to sell better. It's this whole wife's tale. And there's nothing more drive me mad when I go to some kitchen, do some training. And you see big boxes of bread, sourdough or whatever bread there, and it's all wrapped in cling film, sweating in there and left on the bench. You know, it's just like they do not understand bread. And that's where we are. We need chef to understand bread, and it will take, you know, a lot of time for chef to understand, appreciate and know how to serve bread properly. It's a few restaurants understand it and it make a big difference for them. But a lot of them like you said, it's gonna be piping hot on the table. What you do that? It's the worst thing you can do to your stomach. It's education. It's all about education all the time. So, you know, bread was not created in one night, so we need to be patient, I think.
I have a few questions from do you bake on occasions just to get bread out of your head?
Say it again.
Do you bake bread on occasion just to get the idea of bread out of your head?
To bake bread to get the bread out of my head.
Yeah.
I don't think I understand the question.
It kind of might be out of a mistranslation, but I think she's trying to say, do you just bake just so you don't think about bread?
I love going to France because I don't have to make bread. It's like a kind of relief sometimes because it's kind of looking for new bread, looking, speaking to the baker. I love buying my loaf of bread, my local baker in my house in France, because I go there, I see the baker, I see the young baker, and he reminds me of me working at their age in a bakery, and remind me of where I was, you know, where I was back in France, and what they're doing, the consistency of the bread. The guy's still there after 10 years I've been to the same house in France. And it's wonderful to see the consistency of it. And talking to have a coffee in the morning with him, you know, talking about how hard it is in France to survive and all the whinging we do in France, of course, you know. But I don't know. Bread is so part of what I do. I don't make it as a kind of pain relief or anything like that. It's just, if I need to make it, I make it. I love selling bread. I love being in my shop on Saturday morning and when people come in. I love the fact I make bread because I know I can sell it. If it's good, it's kind of a big grin on my face when I open the oven and all the bread is fantastic. And selling good bread to people because I know it makes them happy. So it's a kind of, you make something to give to people. It's not about the money side of it. It's a satisfying process of it. It's kind of, bread is funny. You pass on something to somebody else, and they got a loaf of bread that's going to last them for a week with them until the next Saturday. And you know, for every day, they might have a little bit of that slice. Part of you has been on their table. It's a great satisfaction, I guess.
And what's your fondest memory connected to bread baking?
Oh, God. I think it's when I first got my first copy in my hand of my first book, Dough. Huh. I think, same like you guys, if you're a big blogger or something, you write blogs and you want to be, you want people to read what you talk about. You want people to recognize what you talk about. And that bread book was in my head for many years. I think since I arrived in England, because I accumulated a lot of knowledge and things like that. And I was getting so angry by the way people wrote about bread or tried to explain everything about bread. And if you look at all the bread book out there, they all call bread something, bread Bible and bread this and the best bread. And bread is a byproduct of dough. You've got to understand the dough before you make bread. When you master the dough, then you master the bread. It might sound weird or something, but most people come to my class, they want to do sourdough. They can't even make a basic white dough properly. So never mind sourdough, never mind, you know, try to like to make a working with foie gras. We can't cook a breast of chicken, so it's a step by step process. You got to understand the basic. Any apprentice need to understand, you know, sweep the floor properly. Then you know how to respect the flour, and then you move on all the time. Now you've got to get in your blood to understand, and understanding the dough is the most important thing for me for when I teach people. My first class, I tell them, if you come here to learn sourdough, don't even think about it. You're going to learn how to make dough properly. And it makes sense. By the end of it, they're absolutely right. And for 30 years, I've been trying to look for this. And it's just about the dough, understanding the dough. You know, the way I make dough, people say it's describing slapping the dough on the table. It is not. This. What I'm teaching is not something I've created. It's something which has been done for hundreds of years. It's been done by people who understood the dough. It's not nothing I've created. You know, it's if you look at what's happening in the mixer, people who created mixer, the Artofex mixer. Do you know the Artofex mixer?
Yeah, I saw one in Switzerland. They're beautiful.
Yeah, those mixer have been created by the guy who created it, stood there looking at the baker the way he make dough. Okay? The guy didn't put oil anywhere. He didn't do this. There was no oil in those days. So what they used to do, they used their brain, they used their hand. They used to understand the dough. So they used to get that, what we call the French technique, is the phrasage, mixing your ingredients together. Then the découpage and passage en tête. So you take the dough, you slap it on one side of the mixer on a big wooden trough. And then the next part with étirage, the stretching of the dough on the front of you, and soufflage, blowing the dough. Okay, and they used to do it for 1 hour. Now, air is very cheap, water is very cheap, flour is very expensive. So why adding flour to your work table when you're kneading the dough and everything? And the kneading technique is working against the dough. It's not working with the dough. You work against it. It's something completely alien to me. I never understood it. Because you put flour to a recipe, you change the recipe, and you try to be consistent all the time. So I never understood why adding flour. And you ask people, why do you don't put flour in the mixer? And they say, no. So why you don't add flour in the mixer, but by hand you just put a ton of flour because it's thick. Yeah. And that's where I will go back to, if you don't understand the dough, if you don't know how to handle the dough, then you got the basic one, you got to understand the dough. So I teach people how to mix 1 kilo by 1.8 kilo to start with to get comfortable. And then per group of four, they teach I teach them to mix 7 kilo all together in one big bowl. And what you find is people understand more about mixing a big amount of dough together because they got to use their whole body. It's a kind of using the whole body to mix a dough. It's going back to the old days. And when they do that, it just makes sense. And when it makes sense after that, they can do sourdough, they can do anything. That's not a problem. It's understanding that water and flour stick, and no book will tell you that.
And what makes your method of your slapping or manipulating the dough different to the, you know, people who are adherents of this gentle folding and lighter kneading and less kneading? I mean, are they basically the same?
I think all the less kneading, the oil on the table, or the other mixing dough in the air and everything else, they, if you give those guys 5 kilo of flour and to make some dough, if I break my mixer break down tomorrow and I got to make 20 or 25 kilo of dough by hand, I can do it. I got no problem. I used to do it before I bought a mixer, before I could afford one. Yeah. So I can mix 20, 21 kilo by hand, no problem at all. That's not the problem. On the table, with two of us, we can mix a dough, no problem. You can't do that by using a kneading technique. You can't use that by any other technique. The technique I use is what they used to do in the old days when they used to understand the dough. If you want to put 65% of water or 70% of water, which for me is normal in a strong bread flour, I can't think of any other technique I could use. A mixer will take 20 minutes to mix a dough. By hand, it'll take you 15 minutes to mix a dough by hand. But 1 kilo will take 7 or 8 minutes. But if it's going to take you 2 hours to mix a dough, where the logic on this if it's a commercial bakery you run? Look at all the mixers being created. They all try to mimic what the hand used to do in the old days. They all try to trap air inside it. They're not pushing the dough out to try to take the air out. And the kneading technique, that's why I was challenged a bit, is completely the reverse of what your hand are meant to do. The Art of X mixer, taking the dough out and lift it up all the time and get all that air inside it gently, all that... understanding of all the, even the Kenwood mixer, they go to that dough and stretch it and slap it on the side of the mixer. If you look at this technique I'm using, it's the same as if you had a video filming from the side, the dough slapping on the side of the bowl and get stretched on the same time. So you work with the dough, you work not against it. And a lot of people come with arthritis or bad shoulder, how do you call them, forearm in here, by kneading, they can't do it.
Yeah.
Because this is such an unnatural position for your body to do this. But this one actually is quite good for the whole body to work with.
And you get big arms.
Well, you get big arms because you use your bum to lift the dough. You use your legs. Your arms are just next, it's like a mixer. If you look at the Art of X mixer, your arms only do what the engine pushed them to do.
Right.
The strength of it doesn't come from your arms. Everything comes from your back, your legs. You got to use the whole body. The baker, if you look at them, they work with their whole body. It's like a kind of ballet dancer. When you look at them, it's quite gracious. The way they move in the bakery, everything they're doing has got a purpose. There's no wasted movement. There's no, because it's a physical job.
Yeah,
you don't have energy doing things you don't need to. So it's a kind of and the dough, you've got to understand. It's the other thing. People get a bit intrigued, and I discovered about 2 years ago, I started teaching this technique, the top and the bottom of the dough. There's two sides on the dough, the non-stick side on the top and the sticky side underneath. And I was doing it for years and years and years, but I started to understand that better now, so I can teach it to people. And that makes a huge difference on people to understand that the top never moves when you mix your dough. So it's the same smooth side on top. If you understand there's two sides of the dough, it's unbelievable what it does, the difference. You've got to understand the dough. The dough moves in a way that there's a sense to it. It's not just a piece of lump you just throw around and, you got to get the dough a bit like part of you.
And it's such a physical job, and, the hours are really long. and strange hours at that.
Yep.
Is retarding the bread for a cooler rise a good thing or bad? And how does it hinder or change the traditional techniques you're trying to teach?
The longer the better. That's my motto. Like sourdough, for example, my sour ferment is refreshed once a week, is in my fridge. I keep it at the same temperature. So I teach people how to make it convenient for home baking also, because I take my ferment with me on holiday. Like, you know, when you make bread, you've got to be in charge of the dough, not the dough is in charge of you. You can never be prisoner of your job. So you've got to control what you're doing all the time. So our ferment is in the fridge. If I go on holiday for 2 weeks, we double it up, triple it up, and keep it in the fridge. When we come back, it's still fine. It doesn't go anywhere, AWOL or anything like that. But this, enough sourdough for our production now is between 12 and 14 degree, 18 hours, very slow proof. I much prefer a sweeter sourdough. You know, sourdough, again, sourdough we think is a bread. Sourdough is actually a technique of baking, not a dough, it's bread itself.
Yeah.
But a lot of people think sourdough, ooh, the word sour has put them off completely. You know, pain au levain, pain campagne, all those bread are what we used to do in the old days. So the slow process of thing was, you know, something they understood. So, but I like it, the slower the better, really. Yeah.
So why did you end up in England rather than staying in France?
Girls.
Okay, that's a good thing. I thought it all had to do with fermenting and things.
It's a long story, you won't have enough time.
Okay. How did you go about starting your school?
Back in 2000, yeah, I set up my own company of consultancy. So I was doing consultancy for a big outlet who was supplying supermarket and all sorts of things like that. So I was going back into baking, but on different scale. It opened my eyes on different things. And at the same time, to keep my eyes on my hand into I started teaching bread classes in one or two baking schools. Cooking school in London, and the way I was doing bread was quite people quite enjoyed it, and for me it was natural. Right, it started to really start. The pain was starting to drop in my head. That's what I was doing was touching people a bit more. I was getting quite confused and really enjoying the way the response people gave me about the classes I was doing. And I think at the time I was thinking of opening a restaurant or do something else like that in London. And then I just, my wife, working as in a law firm in London, we tried to find a job to do together without being on the top of each other. So the cooking school idea came up, and it's like, well, let's do a cooking school, why not? And teach bread and teach this and get guest chef coming in. And so the concept grew from there. So we looked stupidly in France to open a looking for an old chateau, redo it, and get all the Brits and everything to come down. And that's where I realized that I was more Anglophile than French. So I've lost except for my accent,
yeah.
I'm pretty more British now than French. And the way we do things in France really wound me up. It's too slow and it didn't work out. So we packed up the idea of France, and then we came back to London and look at the map and identify Bath, where we are now, as actually a great place to set up the business. So we did a few recce, found our beautiful building where we are now, and never looked back really, open. And from some guys from New York, Goa magazine came when we first opened, the book came out on the same time as we opened, and we never looked back. It just gone ballistic from then. So it's, I own a lot to Gourmet and Roof, and a few guys from Gourmet, because they did a nice piece on us a few times and been big fans since day one. So it's been good, and we teach a lot of people from the state. I mean, every 5 day bread class we're doing, we got booking up for 2 years in advance with some people from Texas to anywhere in America. It's incredible. I'm from Canada, from everywhere, from Singapore, from it's worldwide now, Japan, everywhere. It's a real phenomenal. So it's he spurred me on. He's like stand-up comedy, but every time they come down, I'm just I'm so confused to teach, you know, teach them. So when they go back, they talk even more and with more people. So it's fantastic. It's a great feeling. Great feeling. You can't beat that. It's incredible.
And what's the state of British baking today? How do you look at it?
Well, there's I think this year was it's a big start of something new. I think the BBC there's a big thing in here called the BBC Food and Farming on Radio 4, which is a big food channel on the BBC. And one baker won the best shop in UK, which was great, and I won the BBC Champion of the Year. So there's two bakers there who've been absolutely recognized for this. And when I look at who won it last year, was Hugh Fairley Whittingstall, and then the year before was Rick Stein, and then Raymond Blanc, all those big names. And now my name is next to them over there. It's like, oh shit, you know. So I think bread's been recognized now as And the, what's amazed me for this big award we got, it's actually the people who've been to our classes, who heard from us and the way we do things, who've been funding the program to nominate us, which for me is absolutely, after 5 years of being open, really, it's the icing on the cake, it's the cherry on the cake. It just proved that what we're doing is right, and it does change people's life. When you understand a bit more about bread, it's such a basic ingredient, you start looking at the packaging, you start looking at what you're eating a bit better, and what you feed your children, and it cascades down a bit more. So it's, I think we're on the rise now, forget the pun, but the bakers are a bit on the rise, and there's so many more bread on TV now, and bakers coming out of the woodwork, and we start to get the image of bakers being a bit more sexy, you know. We all see a baker with a blue hairnet on the head and looking actually like the cricket umpire, you know.
Well, I hope they don't get like, you know, like star chefs with a big head, because bakers are a lot more humble than chefs.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I don't think it will happen, but I think it's we need to see how things happen. That's bakers need to get together a bit more, and there's, I think we had a level now back in the, if you remember the 80s, when few chefs came up at the top and they were all fighting for the top spot, there's kind of excitement about the new wave from Marco Pierre Gordon. When they all came up all together, it was absolute madness. And now I think bakers happen the same way. You know, you've got a few bakers rising to the top there and a few making bread interesting. I think it's going to, to get more people, there's more bakers. I train so many chefs now, it's incredible. There's so many young chefs who are interested into it and go back to kitchen and get confused about bread, and bread become better on the restaurant. So that's the way we're going to change things, you know. It's make chefs understand that the value of bread on their table, and it's not just a lump of bread or hot bread you put there, we just fill up people. It's a bit more than that.
It has a bigger palate. You were talking about how in France some of the bakers have difficulties with keeping business open, and you know how small bakeries are kind of dying out. And I mean, even here in New York, we're supposed to be the capital of food, I guess, or we used to be. And I find that most of the bakeries here are just wholesale bakeries with a few outlets. How do people who really want to become good bakers or great bakers open a small business? I mean, the commodities are high, rents are high. What's your idea for the ideal business plan to be a small baking business?
You put it right on the head there. It's all the bakery you got now in New York. They're all, to make money with bread, you need volume.
Yeah.
There's no, people don't understand the value on bread. They don't understand that if you ask anybody in UK how much is a loaf of bread, nobody can tell you. If you go to France, how much is a baguette, they will tell you the price of a baguette. We don't understand the price of bread, but what we know is if you pay £5 or I don't know, in dollar, how much is 5 quid for 1.2 kilo, which is my shop, people think, wow, that's expensive. But now my customers know what value they get from it. But if they will pay £3 for a cup of coffee from Starbucks. We lost the value on bread, which is very, very hard. So if you're a young baker, you want to start your own business, and if you make 200 loaves a day, you will close down. Is how do you add value to that? How do you make your bread not just a loaf of bread, but something a bit more added value? People will pay £5 for a sandwich, which is going to fill them up in 1 minute, but they will not pay £5 for a loaf of bread, who's made in 18 hours, who's going to last them for a week. It's something that we need to change. Is how much is bread? How much, you know? And my big fight I've got at the moment is I would love to change the laws in Europe. Would be to any bread from a supermarket with all those additives and everything else in there. If this was called a different name, if it was called bread type product, for example, then people will stop and read the packaging and not buy it as bread. But if you're a small baker, how can you survive when your loaf of bread that you takes so long to sell for $3, $4, $5 or whatever? And next to that, you got an 800 gram white slice for 50 cents. How can you justify, if they both call bread, to somebody who doesn't know anything about bread, that yours is better than this one? We need to go back to the value on bread, to understand the value of bread. And that's really, really hard. We understand meat. We've done the meat. We understand the fish. We understand everything. But we still don't understand the value on bread.
I think it's because people didn't grow up eating good bread, like, say, in France or in Germany. Or they've forgotten the tradition completely because of
the industrialization. In France, if you look in France, if you speak to a lot of people now, they all see France change. You know, they don't understand bread. They want crap bread. They want convenience.
Yeah.
They all kebab shop. They got pizza place everywhere. Now, I'm not saying anything bad about pizza. Pizza, I love pizza, but good pizza. But there's a lot of takeaway culture coming in. So they will pay £5 for a crap pizza, no thinking twice about it, or £15 for it. But they will not pay for good bread because they just think bread should be convenient. And it's so wrong. It's so wrong. I don't know what's happened. We lost the value on bread, and we need to go back to it. We need to go to re-understand. And that's why we can't be too snobbish about it. We can't be too elitist. That if you sell, if you're a small baker, you can't just say my bread is the best or my bread is this. Not everybody will love every baker's bread. Every baker's bread would be different. Everybody's palate would be different.
Sure.
So we need to make the bread for the people, and for them to understand what they're eating and the price they're going to pay for their loaf of bread. It's going to take a while for everybody from all the different class to understand that, because you can't say somebody who's on a £20 a week income to feed five children that you must eat sourdough because it's good for you or everything else. They will tell you two fingers and say, you know, I got five children. If I can buy five loaf of bread for a couple of pounds from the supermarket, I'm going to buy them. And I completely understand that. You know? But what we've got to understand is people who can afford it is to read the packaging. So the white sliced bread as we know it will never change. It will always be there. But we need to change the name of it. So people whose brain can understand a bit more, and people with money can start reading the packaging and understand what they're eating. But don't call the white sliced bread or that highly processed stuff bread. It should be called a different name.
Yeah.
The day we do that, the day we do this, then a small baker will have a chance to fight. You can't call them both bread because people will never understand. It took me, some of my best friends in here, it took me 4 years to make them realize that the bread, the sliced bread they buy is not bread. And they couldn't understand it. And now they buy my sourdough or my bread, and they understand when they eat it, it's actually not just a convenience that they put in the toaster. It's something that is substantial. It's something that they really eat and enjoy it. So it's more than that. But it took, when you're used to something for so many years, it takes a long time to change. So if my best friend told me, some of my best friends take 4 years to convince, you know, for people Joe Blow from the street, it will take them years and years and years. So if we change the name of it, make people realize what they're eating and read the packaging, then the small baker would have a chance.
I have that problem at home too. My wife always complains, "Oh, your bread's too crusty. It's, you know, it's too this and that." I'm like, "Are you kidding me?"
But you know, the point she's got there is, if you make a big loaf, you go home, you got no knife to slice it, your bread become, whoa, it's a pain in the ass. You can't. It's not convenient anymore.
Yeah.
So if you have a good bread knife, how can you use a good sourdough?
Well, I have a good bread knife.
I'm sure you have.
But, you know. She's just being a pain in the neck.
Like everything, we want to change everything in one day, but we can't. It's impossible. It'll take time. It's understanding people's mentality. It's understanding people the way they eat. Why do they buy that bread? Because it's convenient. And we've created the conveniency. We've created that bread. Now we created that sugar process and everything else. And to change it, it will take time. You can't fight. We can't ban the bread. It's impossible. It's worth too much money for the industry. We can't fight it. The only way we can fight it is not call it bread. And that will really, really piss them off big time, because if we can get the government to agree on this one or something and get a big movement around it and not ban it, because that's what they expect. They would say ban the bread, but we will never be able to do that. But changing the name, there's a chance there that we can actually make the small baker all stand together and say, you know, have something to fight about. That people can read the packaging and make their own mind. And I really believe strongly that you can make very good bread on big scale. It's been done, it's still been done now, but there's plenty of bread out there which is horrible and shouldn't be called bread. So it's not being too elitist also about bread. You've got to be realistic about bread. And if you're a small baker, you want volume. You don't make any money otherwise. Yeah.
Wow. I guess I'm going to have to keep chefing then.
No, I mean, the other thing is I don't know, is what you do with your bread. Are you going to say, if you just sell a loaf of bread, you know, if you make a, you can make the math very easy. You make 100 sourdough a day, and you're going to sell for a few dollars, if there's 300 gram each or whatever. You make 200 quid a day, you know.
Yeah.
For 200 quid a day or 300 quid a day, the time it's going to take you to make all of them perfect all the time, every day. Because when you start doing your bakery, you can't stop. So it's an ongoing process all the time. You need to make so many loaves to make money out of it. And that's a C. And to be consistent, and you'll never trust any other baker to do it for you, because it's going to take you 10 years to train somebody who thinks the same way and everything. And that's where the craft is. You know, you can buy some stuff. You can buy a cheap car, and you know exactly what you buy, or you buy a bloody good car, and it's going to last. You know, same with shoes, same with everything. We can buy very cheap shoes; we don't expect it to last. So, if you buy a good pair of shoes, they'll last you longer, but it's made differently. So, I think people lost track of what bread's all about, and we need to go back to the basic root of good bread versus bad bread, and bad bread should be called bread. You know, it's a simple thing. It's so simple that it's scary sometimes, but we need to get everybody, you know, from New York, from everywhere, to stand up and say, actually, that should be called bread, and then see what the reaction is. It'd be interesting.
or they should all be taught how to make good bread, so that way they can recognize.
I've seen bread plants. I work with companies who make the bread on big bread plant. They're not bakers, so it's ingredients put together to make something which is convenient. Okay,
yeah.
And the problem is the definition of bread is a mixture of water, flour, leavening agent, and processed together.
Right.
That's the definition of bread in dictionary. But now, what's the definition of real bread? And we were fighting for that. You know, what's real bread? What that bread? So maybe we need a new definition. Maybe we need the European market to change a law. We need a new law for it, maybe. If you ask those bakers online, they'll tell you they're not baker. They press button. It's one on one side, one on the other, and 10 diamond loaf every hour coming out. You know, it looks like bread, smells like bread when it's fresh, but it's absolutely rubbish for your guts. So, you know, it's we should be able to do something about it.
Yeah, kind of like par baking. That's really, I hate that stuff.
Well, it's all part of the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
Flour is a byproduct of wheat, and the problem, if the flour, again, if you look at all the baking books, flour was something you mill, you let rest for, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks. Mine is at least 3 months. But if you did that nowadays, you mill wheat and store it for 3 months before you can bake with it. The price will go bang mad,
yeah.
Because the storing the flour will cost so much money for the industry that your loaf of bread will triple in price. So it's not convenient. So everything is milled very, very fast on the high speed rollers. All the starch, everything's gone, goes straight on the back of a lorry, straight into the factory and pump into it. So to replace time, we put additive. You can't replace time. So you put chemical instead to replace it, to reform what they're destroying.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure there's some way of making good bread on big scale, but we'll have to pay a bit more for it, I think. You know?
Sure.
And I would love to be able to do that, making good bread on big scale.
Something like on the scale of Poilin, maybe, with his big bakery that he has out there outside of Paris.
Poilin is my hero from very young age. I was in Paris 3 weeks ago and to see Apollonia over there and see the baker. You know, the oven has been fired since 1732, you know.
Yeah.
And you go in there, it's all about soul. It's all about, you look at the baker working there. The guy's great. When I met Poilin, I was like, wow, you know, that's why I love baking, because he knows. If you read his bread, his book, Le Guide de l'Amateur de Pain, his little book there. When you read it, I feel it's me talking, because it's like the way I felt when I was in the bakery at 4 o'clock in the morning. The way you listen to the noise outside, everything is different. It's a way of life. Everything is different at that time of the night.
Yeah.
Your brain's thinking differently. It's a kind of routine all the time. And it's fascinating. And he was supposed to write the preface for my French version of the book. And of course he died. So Apollonia wrote the preface for me in French. And I admire them. So I admire a lot for what they're doing. You know, carry on and make bread on such a big scale, but all perfect. And if one baker is sick, then the oven doesn't work. So it's very personal and doing very well.
I have a few more questions for you. I don't want to keep you on.
Yeah, it's all right. It's all right. Send it.
What would you eat for your last meal? It's another question from our friend in Spain.
My last meal would be the biggest seafood platter in the world. So a lot of crab, a lot of lobster, a lot of langoustine, any seafood, 3 bottles of biscuit or good wine, and my sourdough and salted butter, and a bit of mayonnaise, and I'd be very happy.
So that says that you're a real Breton.
Real Breton always come back out, yeah.
Yeah. What are some of the uniquely Breton breads or food traditions that you still, you know, hold up in your repertoire?
Yeah, we still, every class, when we get a little break at during the class, I always serve my customers some prunes soaked in rum. Mm. And anybody who's come to my class will be laughing now when they hear that. It's a kind of a perk you up stuff. We get a massive jar full of prunes soaked with dark rum. And that's what I grew up in Brittany with. We always had this with coffee. You know, it's very, very nice. So I make a far breton, which is a recipe in my book, Crust,
yeah.
Where it's a kind of batter, bread pudding. It's a very old-fashioned breton recipe. And we make one recipe with this. We make some prune, cardamom, and rum bread as well. So that's prune into the brand or something. It's fabulous with cheese. So, yeah, I'm influenced by my roots, I think. I use buckwheat flour quite a lot. We use buckwheat in Brittany quite a lot. And salted butter. I love cooking and baking with salted butter. I love it. It's where I come from.
Who would you invite for your fantasy dinner party if you had one?
Who would I invite? How many people am I allowed?
Oh, as many as you like.
I would love to have Ruth Reichel back, because she came to spend 3 days with us in Bath in here with the actress Diane West. Diane West, yeah, they can, and to meet such a big star like Diane was like a incredible. Java in my kitchen was even more incredible, and she's so genuine, and we had a ball, and she was saying to me, if you come to New York, come and we'll hang around. So I can't wait to come to New York and give her a ring and hang around with her.
All right.
But Riff was quite not intimidating is the wrong word, but quite a phenomenal person to have in my kitchen, because he's such a big name and such a well-known food. And to be able to teach somebody something new was just incredible. Overwhelmed a little bit by having them both in the kitchen with me. And Poilane, I would love to have Poilane back on the, if you can come back for a day, it'd be great as well. And my wife and my children, that'd be great.
Perfect. Who were some of your mentors and influences in the past and present?
People who influenced me. I would say, again, Poilane, by the way he wrote about bread, and the way he sell bread, the way he understand what's going on. And my old boss, the one who teach me the method I'm using now, my old Monsieur Guillaume, my old baker from my apprenticeship, who said to me, "Well, I'll show you how to do band like we used to in the old days. It might be useful for you one day." I thought he was right. Who else? There's so many people. I think life is a kind of a, it's hard to pinpoint who challenged you. I mean, it's one or two people like I just named, but every time I meet somebody, I learn something. Every time a guest chef coming to the kitchen, I learn something new, the way they do something, the way they hold something. You learn. It's a big jigsaw, and it's never ending. It just grows and grows all the time. So every time you meet somebody, it can be from an artist to a film star, or whatever, there's something you learn from them all the time. And you just, as great people, you always give away part of themselves. And I think if you get so many bits to give away, then people take a bit of you. And that, it's that kind of ferment you give away to people. And that's part of your, and you build it up all the time. So
and
it's,
it grows.
Sorry?
And it grows like a wild
it grows.
Beast.
No, exactly. I think it's a, that it, I think it's knowledge, really. So you, if you respect people who teach you, that's fantastic. I'm lucky to have all those big names coming around the kitchen all the time, teaching classes, and I get so much out of this. It's incredible. And teaching young chef is phenomenal. I love teaching young chef, because they always come with a kind of a, well, I know everything, and by the end of it, they're just bowled over, you know, completely, and they are confused and going back, and they want to make bread and learn something new, which is great. And teaching people who've been baking for 30 years and always say, "I want a light crust, nice texture," and all that, but it's always very heavy. And you ask the three questions: do you knead the dough? Yes. Do you put flour? Yes. Do you do this? Yes. Well, you can keep on doing it, you never achieve it. And they don't understand the beginning. By the end of the class, they say, "For 30 years, I've been trying to make bread that way, and never understand it." It's so simple that we make it so complicated. And if you look at every bread book, they all use the same technique. Add a bit more flour if it's sticky, add a bit more water, and mix to a light, separate elastic dough. What does that mean? If you don't know, if you never see it, that's why the DVD is very useful with our book, because it just takes you a step further to us to understand the dough. And I think teaching is, you can't hide the recipe, you can't hide anything, you got to give it to people. And I try to give as much as I can to every class I'm doing, for people to get back and really believe that they can do it. Actually, they can do it. I can talk for hours about this, but yes. You can come down here and do a class with us. You see what I mean. And, you know, people will tell you, not me. It's even better.
Oh, no, I was reading somebody's tweet today. It said that you had, like, the sexiest lobes. So I said, wow.
Yeah, I practice the French accent all the time, you see.
Yeah, I know. My last question for you is, Burtonette Kitchens, are you going to be putting them in other countries?
You know, it's what we talked about extension earlier. You know, I could take, you know, a bigger site and teach, you know, 30 people at a time, but then I will lose everything I've created. I teach 12 people at a time, and I spend plenty of time with them, you know, over the day or 5 days or something like that. And I much rather do that for my own health than to have 30 people. I've done classes for 30 people, and believe me, I run so much to get everybody to understand. But I love the building where we are. I would love to have to be able to be more busy and to have the financial cushion so I could come and spend, do some pop-up classes in New York and Spain, and to have the, not to have to do it for money, but to do it just for the pleasure. You know, it would be, I would love to be able to jump on a plane and go to New York again and do 5 days over there, 5 or 6 days of teaching people over there, because I loved it so much. There's so much passion over there as well. It's fantastic. Astor is a fabulous cooking school there. Uh-huh. Massive amphitheater. When I was, I'm sure you can Google it somewhere, you'll find it. It's got the most beautiful wine shop as well. I can't remember where it was.
Right.
It's Astor Center.
Astor Place.
Yeah, it could be there. Yeah. Fabulous. I did a class there. I loved it there. Very, very good
right,
day.
Right.
I would love to be able to move the kitchen, you know, 1 week every 6 months to New York and come and teach bread over there. But I need to get my head right. I can make money out of it and not lose any. That's, it's always about money, you know, the flight and everything else and do that. Maybe I get sponsorship or something, I have to do it. But if you know anybody who's, you got plenty of money and doesn't know what to do with it. Just, you know.
Exactly.
But I would love to go around the world and do a bit more. You know, it's and meet all the baker. You know, I would love to go back to New York and meet all those guys who bake over there and are passionate about it. There's so much to be done. So it's a good job. It's a good job, and there's so many different techniques. You know, so many different recipes and so many different thing you learn, and so it's never ending, really. So,
well, you're helping us a lot, the home bakers and wannabe bakers.
Hey. Yeah. No, but there's so many. I'm amazed how many blogs. The problem, I'm so crap with computer. I can't type quick enough, so I give up with computers. I'm very good with Adobe, but with computer, my hand, I can't type on the bloody thing.
Yeah.
But I read a lot of the blog and what's going on the bread stuff and the fresh loaf and all those other guys.
Yeah.
And it's phenomenal how people are interested into bread and what they do with it. So
it's a passion.
It is a passion. And I laugh a lot because a lot of the questions, if I start answering them, I'll be there all night answering back to them. I know I must not go into too much into conversation because I can see where the problem is. I can see where they're struggling. It's so frustrating because I would love to help everybody, but I can't.
Yeah.
My wife would kill me if I start.
There you go.
But it's fascinating how many people are interested into it. And I see the DVD is a good thing on our book because it did help a lot of people to believe that you actually can work the dough without any oil, water, or being scared of the dough.
Yeah.
And look at the bakers. When somebody teach you bread or something, like that, look at the way their hand work with the dough. The hand will tell you everything. When they're scared of it, the whole body shows they're scared of the dough. You've got to be confident with the dough. Show the dough's boss. When you master that thing there, then you're in charge. Then you win it. Don't ever, ever let the dough take over your life.
There you go. Well, thank you very much. Merci beaucoup.
Oh, hi-han, hi-han.
Oh, ben dis donc, hein? Okay, thanks very much.
Yes, Tom, thank you. If you need any help, you know where we are now. Just tweet me or anything like that. I'll let you know when I come to New York, and then we go for a beer, definitely.
Definitely, or several beers.
Oh, yeah, probably. Yeah.
And
I'll show you to make Guinness bread.
Oh, yeah, that's the one I want to try next. Actually, a baker from Spain, Javier Marca, wanted to say hello to you.
Oh.
Yeah.
Say hello to me back as well. Okay. It's funny, my book just came out in Spain as well.
Yeah.
I got a massive follow-up in Spain now. I want to, it's not far from us, so I'd have to go there as well.
Yeah, I think I'm going this summer to meet all these guys that I interviewed so I can finally see what they're up to.
Fantastic. Okay.
Okay, thanks a lot.
No worries. Cheers. Thank you.
Ciao.
Bye.